possible about 10 months after surgery. Cimetidine helps reverse the suppression of the T suppressor cells, which in turn helps keep the levels of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes up. If I had discovered this vital piece of evidence before my lung operation, I have little doubt I would have taken it after my lung operation for those critical 7 days. Cimetidine is also sometimes effective against Epstein-Barr virus, even when the virus is latent, and this is implicated, along with the HPV virus and MMTV, for activating many breast cancers. When the patent lapsed, cimetidine went out of fashion in the UK, and unless you have friends in either Canada, the US, or Germany, where it's still available over the counter, it can be hard to obtain. Ranitidine, Zantac, an H2 inhibitor, and ceritizine, H1 inhibitor, are both readily accessible antihistamines that can be bought over the counter. These may be useful for both their antiviral and anti-cancer effects, boosting tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes and helping to protect the gut from gastric bleeds, possibly working best together. As always, check with your health practitioner. Perhaps I should have been more confident about my aspirin use, which I took cyclically a few weeks on, a few weeks off, put off by my surgeon. A study by Professor Peter Elwood at Cardiff University School of Medicine, looking at the overall risk of stomach bleeds using aspirin, had shown there was no increased risk of death from stomach bleeding in people who take regular low-dose aspirin, 75 mg, and that the spontaneous bleeds from non-users were far more dangerous. Elwood hoped his study would make doctors more comfortable prescribing aspirin. Other research agrees. Low doses of aspirin, given alongside chemoradiation, boost the effects of this therapy and increase the 5-year progression-free survival, 86.6% versus 67.1%, with a lower risk of metastasis. Generally, caution is needed giving aspirin alongside chemotherapy, as this could increase the risk of bleeding. But there are benefits to adding it to radiation therapy. My rationale was, and still is, that all these little additions were not just cumulative, but worked in synergy, multiplying each other's effects. If I approached from all these different directions, would I be able to tip the odds back in my favor and steer a course to health? The early use of anti-inflammatory drugs and growth blockers, like the humble aspirin, made so much sense to me. Why was it that oncologists and surgeons, who should know these facts, still resisted? When faced with overwhelming odds of failure, why was it unreasonable to try a combination that might produce a synergistic and potent anti-cancer formula? If 90% of deaths are a direct result of the cancer spreading, stopping 20% of metastases would improve cancer survival statistics significantly. And that's just with aspirin. It is shocking that only in 2016 did Cancer Research UK begin a trial of aspirin, the Add Aspirin trial, but at dangerous levels of 100 milligrams, 300 milligrams, and even 600 milligrams. It's a double-blind trial, meaning neither the patient nor the doctor will know the dosage given. If and when patients end up with stomach bleeding as a direct result of these higher doses, will they then claim that the risk is too great, putting cancer patients off taking it and thereby keeping the pharmaceutical industry alive? Every other piece of research suggests the half dose of 75 milligram is enough, and the evidence is there to see. Professor Peter Rothwell has run many trials on aspirin, all reported in The Lancet or Lancet Oncology. Simply, I believe the trial is not needed and is a waste of public money. It would be more productive for the cancer charity to lobby NICE to change their guidelines and list low-dose aspirin as an anti-cancer medication. If you're one of the intended 11,000 participants in the Add Aspirin trial, I urge you to check the literature and discuss with a doctor familiar with gastrointestinal problems before taking what could be potentially harmful levels of anticoagulants. Consider taking a smaller amount of aspirin, otherwise you may be putting yourself at unnecessary risk of harm. In the meantime, patients could needlessly die without that small preventive dose. As Benjamin Franklin said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Ah, but there is no money to be made in prevention. Many natural substances can help reduce inflammation. I had included quite a few of them in my pre-surgery regime. Ginger, curcumin from turmeric, and of course, omega-3 fish oils, clinically proven to reduce inflammation and increasingly used in lieu of drugs for conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis. All these supplements have well-researched anti-cancer effects. Even old-school oncologists know of curcumin. They don't suggest it, though. As I went about discovering more about cancer, I realized I needed to reduce something called vascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF. VEGF is a main stimulator of tumor growth, encouraging the development of new blood cells to feed itself, a process called angiogenesis. Aspirin, as well as reducing inflammation, also reduces angiogenesis. At this point, my menu of supplements was as follows. Green tea, with high levels of the catechin ECGC. Ellagic acid, found in pomegranates, raspberries, walnuts, and very hard to source as a supplement at the time. Resveratrol. Psilocybin, milk thistle. Pycnogenol. B vitamins, sublingual methylated form of B12 and folate. Glucosamine sulfate. Curcumin. CLA. Pycnogenol, like aspirin, can increase the risk of bleeds, so it needs to be taken with caution. It's a patented blend of several bark extracts. Aspirin comes from bark too, but it can also lower blood sugar. I took it with aspirin even though I might have been doubling their risks, reasoning that cancer patients have far worse risk of blood clots. As instructed, I stopped all anticoagulants several days, some surgeons suggest a week, before my operation. I had no intention of bleeding to death on the operating table. The operation went well with no complications. One third of my lung was gone. Oh well, I could live with that. Pre-op, I'd had exceptionally good lung volumes, above normal, so now I was about average. Damn, I didn't like being average. After surgery, my blood antigen markers were taken again. Post-surgical metastatic spread is a common problem, and I knew that blocking VEGF with the aspirin perioperatively would have helped, but waiting to hear the results made me feel sick with worry. It took all day to summon the courage to phone up to find out. On the one hand, I wanted to stay in denial. But on the other, I knew I needed to plot and chart these markers. My head eventually won the argument. Sticking it in the sand was not going to help. Andrew stood next to me as I received the news. I was gutted to learn my markers had surged to a new high, a reading of nearly 600, up from 190, despite my best efforts. Normal was anything under 150. This meant I now had tumor cells roaming around my body and my blood. I couldn't bear to think about it. I was so dismayed. I told myself it was to be expected. Surgery always did this. But I was incredibly disappointed. I felt I was failing already. My positive mood sunk again. Would I ever get back in the driving seat, or did the cancer now control me? Medical interventions had made me worse, but I was hoping this was just a temporary problem. Had I tipped it to the point of no control? Was I powerless to defeat it? How could I get those markers down now? Had surgery been a mistake? Andrew was far more practical. We knew that was going to happen. You told me the markers would go up. Try not to worry about it too much. It won't help. You always said there'd be a spillage of tumor cells and inflammation. Let's stick to the plan and keep those tumor cells whizzing around your system. You told me it was when they got stuck in the blood vessel wall that they can metastasize. He was right. I had decided the best strategy would be to keep those pesky cells in my circulation and not allow them a chance to settle, to cling to the blood vessel linings, endothelium, and set up camp somewhere else in my body. It was the metastases or secondary cancers that caused death. If I kept the little blighters moving with aspirin, an anticoagulant, might my army of cancer-killing white cells be able to pick them off? Aspirin was also an antiplatelet drug. If the platelets were kept from forming little clumps that hid the tumor cells, would my natural killer cells, my white cell army, find it easier to win? I now added natokinase, an enzyme supplement that digests fibrin, to reduce my tendency to excessive scarring. Combined with the aspirin, they would help keep my blood from becoming too sticky. With hindsight, some blood clotting tests, rather than just self-hacking, would have been useful. Clotting issues can be a tricky and very personalized area, requiring professional advice. Getting this wrong could be dangerous. After the operation, life was a daily ritual of green and apple, carrot, celery, beetroot juices, swallowing pills, meditating, and engaging in gentle exercise, such as a brisk walk or a bike ride. Then came the dilemma of chemotherapy. I wasn't sure what to do, but now that my cancer markers had shot up so high, chemo seemed the right choice. It would help mop up the potential of micrometastases, any little clumps of cancer cells. However, it would also suppress my immunity. What if I only had enough chemo to kill cancer, but not enough to wreck the immune cells in my gut? Perhaps I could have halved the normal dose for twice as long. It might be less damaging. Why did I have to have the maximum tolerated dose anyway? Was more really better? It seemed so brutal and one-dimensional. Given that I was already attacking the cancer from so many angles, was it possible that chemotherapy could be equally effective at much smaller doses? And were there drugs or supplements that might synergize with chemotherapy? I'd discovered green tea, resveratrol, and curcumin all made it more effective and decided to carry on with these if the nausea would allow it. When I had raised the subject of taking supplements with chemotherapy to my oncologist, her response had been immediately negative. You have to try and make this as effective as possible. Antioxidants can wreck chemotherapy's power. It's best if you avoid all of them. But green tea was an antioxidant. So was resveratrol. Both had well-reported anti-cancer effects in combination with chemo. I deduced there were particular antioxidants that were synergistic with chemotherapy and others that might interfere. I was not convinced she was right. The articles I had read stated quite clearly that there were benefits. Ultimately, I decided that chemo was something I probably had to undergo, despite my huge reservations. I was under a lot of pressure not just from the oncologist, but also from my family. I knew if I refused, it would cause enormous stress for them. They'd be terrified that I was turning it down and doing nothing, passively waiting for cancer to return. But to me, chemo felt like passive acceptance. As I have come to realize, many patients die of politeness to their oncologist and fear of upsetting their loved ones. It happens far more than anyone would imagine. Relatives and friends wade in with their personal opinions on what you should do, pushing for high-dose toxic treatments because that's what the men and women in the white coats recommend. Conversely, some well-meaning relatives put patients off chemo altogether, when it could be so much more effective if used differently. Oncologists give either the maximum tolerated dose or a palliative dose. Too much or too little. Neither will be curative. Where is the sensible middle ground? One that doesn't crucify the immune system. perhaps a low dose of chemotherapy that is used in combination with other treatments? Being ill